Commonwealth and this honorable court.
Y'all may be seated. Court sits today en banc on two cases before the court. Madam Clerk, will you call the first case, please?
Justin Scott Jones versus Commonwealth of Virginia, Gary Vanderbilt for appellate, Craig Stollard for appellate.
Good morning, counsel. If you'd like to pour some water for yourselves, take a moment to get settled in, and when you're ready, Mr. Vandenbroek will have you proceed to the podium. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
4 minutes. Thank you.
We're ready.
We're ready when you are, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the court. My name is Aaron Vandenbroek, and I represent the appellant, Justin Scott.
Can you speak up, sir? I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize. I'm usually told that I speak.
I'm getting old, sir.
Kidding.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. So before moving on to my argument section, there were just a couple of things that I wanted to point out. In the Attorney General's brief after the rehearing en banc was granted, there were a couple things that were changed in the statement of facts that I just wanted to point out because they're important for the argument section later. Most important of which is that in the Attorney General's argument section, he refers back to prior facts that say that the three co-defendants, my client, Mr. Boyce, and Tripp, who is the one who planned the robbery, that they were all encountered at the rear of 125 South Market Street, where the Commonwealth is alleging that the robbery is supposed to occur. This is incorrect. What the facts actually show is that three individuals arrived in a vehicle. The police observed the individuals get out of the vehicle. One crosses the street into an alley. A number of minutes later, the other two cross the street into the alley and are followed by the police. That first individual, after he gets out of the car and walks into the alley, is never seen again. Never occurs, comes up again in the statement of facts. The police did not arrest him on scene with the other co-defendants. It's flatly wrong. The reason that this is important is that who the Commonwealth is alleging that third individual is, Tripp, he's the one who planned the robbery, and he was not found on scene when my client and Mr. Boyce encountered the police.
In fact, the victim had not even arrived. Planned victim had not even arrived, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. So the victim was never encountered on scene, and the two residences that my client and Mr. Boyce were walking between, it was never determined who owned those residences. No one ever actually spoke to those individuals. So we have no idea whether or not the victim was there. We know the person who planned the robbery was not there.
There was no evidence at all that the alleged victim even frequented that location. The only thing would be an inference that that's where they happened to drive.
That is correct, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that supports that.
Let me ask you kind of a fundamental question here. The evidence shows that they assembled together, they had a weapon, they had ski masks, they got in the car, and they headed somewhere towards or to the intended victim.
Yes, sir.
Why isn't that more than mere preparation? When they got in the car and actually started driving that way, why doesn't that constitute a minimal act in furtherance of the intent?
So if I may, Your Honor, there's a couple points. First, in terms of the specific case law in this case, Jordan and Hobson are the controlling cases on point. In Jordan,
those were panel cases. Hmm? Those were panel cases, weren't they?
We can do whatever we want. They're only
controlling if we say they're controlling.
You're in a little different posture.
That is
right
correct.
Now.
That is correct, Your Honor. That your honors could reverse them at this point. But yes, those were the cases that are on point. But those are the cases that I have.
Probably be helpful to tell us why you don't think we should adjust that thinking.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think what is important from what the previous case law shows, including these Supreme Court cases, is that the act in furtherance needs to go farther than merely being a slight act in furtherance. So first, let me say where this comes from. Yes,
don't those cases say that a slight act in furtherance is sufficient if there is no question as to intent? And given your client's statement, there is absolutely no question as to intent here.
So what I have seen, Your Honor, is that the cases say that a slight act Rogers and Fortune say that a slight act in furtherance will be sufficient, but then
Stop right there.
Yes,
I think the money question here that all of us are trying to get you to answer is simply, where does mere preparation end and an attempt begin? Where, hypothetically, if I'm going to knock over a 7-Eleven day after tomorrow, and so I have the criminal intent, and I decide I need to steal a car so my license plate number isn't taken down by a bystander, and I'm going to acquire a gun somewhere, so I go steal a car, and then the next day I acquire a gun, and then I go to the location. At what point along that continuum have I gone from mere preparation to an attempt? In other words, in furtherance of what is the operative language, I think. So tell us where to draw that line.
Yes, Ron. So there's two Virginia Supreme Court cases that I think already laid that out. So the first is Higgs, which says that the act must become the commencement of the consummation of the offense. So the final act that has to be completed, that would actually result in the completion of the crime, that act has to commence. That is later put in more amiable language in Bloom v. Commonwealth.
Well, it doesn't have to be the last clear act, does it? In other words,
that's correct.
Do I understand your answer to be basically there has to be some linkage to an element of the offense? Or in other words, if I, having stolen the car and acquired the gun, is it your position that when I walk in and pull the gun out of my pocket, has an attempt begun yet, or do I have to actually say, give me the money, and then, but something intervenes that I don't actually acquire the money? I mean, where are you telling us to draw the line?
At the point that you have all of the things together that you need to complete the crime, and you've actually begun your move towards the completion
of the
crime.
Okay, well, let me ask you on that.
Yes,
because they say they picked up Tripp, apparently picked up Boyce, but he picked up Tripp, they drive to the scene, they back in so the car is ready to take off, they let Tripp out. He goes into this alley. A few minutes later, they get out and they say they suit up. It's not clear whether they're putting on the mask then that they have, or they put up the hoodies, and then they take anywhere from 4 to 7 minutes, depending upon the two officers' testimony. They then walk across the street into the alley, and they move in the alley behind that house, to the back corner of that house. If they have everything together based on what you just said, they have the gun, they have the mask, they have all these things together, the hoodies down, they're hunched over as they're going in, they're moving in, they obviously think Strickland is there. Whether he's there or not, or whether the police intercept them first, why haven't they made the move at that point that is that one act that's ineffectual in the end, but it's an act?
I think what's important here, and this is why I began with the clarification from the statement of facts, Your Honor, is that to say that they had everything in place and were prepared to commence the act, we would have to say that the co-defendants who are going to complete the crime were assembled together at the place where the crime was supposed to occur. That is part of the preparation of the offense, which is what we see in Jordan and Hobson and Rogers and the other cases. So the person who actually planned the offense, this Tripp individual, was not present when the police arrived. It is speculated that Tripp is the third individual who was there by the Commonwealth, but it has never been flatly shown because he was not encountered on the scene. It could have been him.
Is it a reasonable inference to draw from the facts?
I think that it is a reasonable inference that they can draw from the facts that third individual was Tripp. What is important is that Tripp was not actually encountered with them. And because of the fact that we don't know where the victim was, we don't know how far they were going to where the crime was actually supposed to occur. What the facts show is that they were in a large area, according to the police, between two residences, and there are some other residences on the other side. It seems to be some kind of a block or a complex.
So, Counselor, is it dispositive in your point of view that they have to know the location of the victim for this to be an attempt?
I think that it's difficult to say that they began a crime when we cannot say where the crime was supposed to occur or who the crime was supposed to occur against. I think it would be difficult to say that someone tried to rob a bank without saying that they had a bank
in mind. Well, is it a reasonable inference, given the statement that when they stopped the car, they believed the victim to be in that area?
I think that saying that they believe the victim to be in that area is a reasonable inference to say that they probably believed that the victim was nearby.
So if he was not there, that would simply be a factual impossibility.
If he was not there, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if he was not there and they were in the middle of trying to complete the crime, that is correct. But there's actually nothing in the record to suggest that he was there. They knew he
Let
was
me follow up on Jake Malvo's question, if I can.
Yes, Your Honor.
One wrinkle here that seems interesting to me, at least, is that in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, your client's statements indicate that he's a principal in the second degree to this third person who's, you know, going to be the principal in the first degree, who's not caught immediately. Can you have someone guilty of an attempt as a principal in the second degree when you don't have a principal in the first degree who's guilty of anything other than mere preparation?
I know that the law says that you can have someone who is convicted as being a principal in the second, even without the principal in the first being caught. But I believe that the wrinkle here is that there is not enough evidence in the record to show that my client admitted to an attempted robbery. The Attorney General construes my client's statement as an admission to an attempted robbery. In fact, that is not what he says. He said that...
Well, if we construe your client's statement as an admission that he's a principal in the second degree, he's going to be there and acting as protection, if you will, for this other individual.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, so, I mean, given that, forget the Attorney General's argument, but given that fact, can you then infer that without a principal in the first degree, you can be guilty as a principal in the second degree of an attempt?
I think that one could make the argument that it is possible that they could be convicted, but it becomes a problem because of the fact that without the principal in the first degree, it becomes very difficult to say that the crime was actually in the middle of occurring.
Turning back to Hobson and Jordan?
Yes, Rob.
Where would you draw... You clearly enjoyed them at the panel and you would like to keep them, but where on the... Assuming that... Where would the crime stop being an attempt and have become a completed crime? Because it seems to me, in Hobson and Jordan, we say what was happening in Hobson and Jordan is enough. If they actually enter the store, the 7-Eleven, I believe it was, the crime is completed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, given that they were walking towards it with masks and guns, what would have been, if we're to retain anything from Hobson and Jordan, at what point would it have become an attempt but not have been a completed crime?
Your Honor, I actually think that Jordan and Hobson are excellent cases for this because of the fact that they had gotten as far as you can get towards the accomplishment of the offense without actually beginning it as you can. They had together all the things that they needed to have.
So attempt would have been impossible under those facts because if they had opened the door and put a foot in, the crime's completed.
I would say that if they had, so if I may, Your Honor, with the facts say that they were around the corner from the store, they were looking at it, they had everything in place. If they had turned that corner and started walking towards the door, I would say, yes, that's attempt. At that point, they started trying to complete the actual offense. They had everything in place. What's distinguishing that from this case and all of the other cases that have been cited in our briefs, what distinguishes that is that in every case that was cited, we have a victim in a set location. We have a place that we know when it's going to be robbed, where it's going to be robbed, who's going to be doing it. Everything is in place, and the question is how far they came. In the present case, we don't know where the victim was. We don't know that they actually planned to encounter.
Counsel, I think everybody would agree that our jurisprudence appears to be somewhat in conflict factually.
Yes, Ron.
Can you articulate a test for how we're to determine cases that may come in the future?
So, Your Honor, if I may, I think that there is a decent test in place. Obviously, attempt is always going to be a difficult case factually, but in Bloom v. Commonwealth, the Supreme Court of Virginia said that the attempted crime must be, quote, in such progress that it will be consummated unless interrupted by circumstances independent of the will of the attempter, and that the act must not be equivocal in nature.
Isn't that what happened here when the police arrived on the scene?
I think that it is arguable, Your Honor, which I think is the issue. The third individual who was actually the one who planned the offense was not found on scene. We have no evidence that the victim was actually there or that they had reason to think
but
that he was going
to be there.
If you say
that, don't you run into a problem? Because if you say it's arguable, then don't we get back to the standard of review as whether a reasonable fact finder could determine based upon these facts that the test was met?
I would say, Your Honor, no, that's fine, Your Honor. So what the law says, and this is Jennings v. Commonwealth, says that they are allowed, and I apologize, arguable is probably a bad phrase to use, but what the law says is that they are allowed reasonable inferences from the facts. But they are not allowed sheer speculation. To say that they had the things that they needed to complete the robbery and to say that they were actually in the middle of completing the robbery are two different points. But if I may, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Vandenbroek. Mr. Stollard?
Good morning. May it please the court. Chris Jellin on behalf of the Commonwealth. Let me start by saying if I got a fact wrong, I would apologize, but I would point the court to appendixes page 55 and 56. This is a testimony regarding Mr. Jones' statement to the police. And in the statement to the police, he said he picked up Mr. Boyce and he picked up Tripp on his way to the parking lot here. So we know Tripp was in the car. We know he got out of the car. What happened after that? Certainly, once the police arrived, anything could have happened. But to the extent I may have suggested he was there when those were arrested,
Mr. Starr, let me ask you this question. If, just hypothetically, what's the Commonwealth's position with respect to an individual who admits that he's going to be a principal in second degree to a crime, but the principal in the first degree never shows up to actually commit the crime at all? In other words, no element of the offense is ever actually executed, but someone shows up, he's going to be present, and he's going to aid and abet, assuming the principal in the first degree ever makes his appearance and does what he's supposed to do. Where would that leave us?
Well, I think the case law is clear that you can have a conviction as a principal in the second degree without having a conviction by the principal in the first degree.
But how would you know to what degree the crime would be attempted, I guess?
Well, I think it would go, again, to the totality of the circumstances. And here what we have is the defendant in this case saying, I'm there to protect Tripp, which, as the court said, again, he makes him principal second degree. There's every indication in this fact, in this situation, anyways, Tripp was in present, he was in the car, he got out of the car, he walked down the alley, same place Mr. Jones was going, same place Mr. Boyce was going. They're all heading in the same direction.
But if you're going to protect him and aid and abet as a principal in the second degree, wouldn't you want to be there when the actual crime started? I mean, isn't that when I would need backup if I'm committing a strong-arm robbery?
I would agree, and I think the fact we have here is the police, of course, they did not expect the police to be observing this when it happened. The police came down the alleyway in the truck, clearly startled them. Two people were apprehended. One, I think the reasonable inference is, fled with the sound of a car coming. So the fact that he wasn't there at the time the police rolled up is more indicative of the fact it was stopped by outside means, not by his own desire to call.
Do we have to look to what the intent of the principal was? Because a principal in the second degree is often, by definition, not present when the crime occurred. So if the getaway driver, if you will, drops the principal in the first degree off three blocks from the scene of the crime, and the principal then at some point abandons the attempt to commit the crime, you can't convict the principal in the second degree. But we don't know here what the intent of the principal in the first degree ever was, or whether he ever really intended to go through with the crime.
Well, I think a reasonable inference is we do. And so I disagree with the court to the extent that's the issue the court seems to have a problem with. Because, again, what we have here are three individuals who have agreed to rob a specific person. They've collected the three individuals. They have a gun. They have a hammer. They have masks, which were recovered. They've parked the car in a situation that makes it an area that's arguably close to where the crime would occur because they wanted it available as a getaway car, and indeed Mr. Jones attempted to use it as such. They get out of the car, they put on the masks or attempt to disguise themselves and walk down the alley.
Where along that continuum did we go from preparation to an attempt then?
I would go back to the Martin case in the Supreme Court. I think the language there is probably the most helpful in this situation. This is on my brief at page 10, and apologize for quoting here. But basically, in a general way, however, it may be said that preparation consists in devising or arranging the means or measures necessary for the commission of the offense, and that the attempt is a direct movement towards the commission after the preparations are made.
So you would have us draw that bright line that Judge Alston mentioned, that when they leave the place of planning,
I think,
and
that
get in the car and head towards the robbery, leaving that place is the abandonment of the preparation and starting to move towards the location of the commission is the direct act.
I think that would definitely be a place the line could be drawn. In this case, you do not need to draw it there. I think here the line could be drawn when they arrived in the parking lot and got out of the vehicle.
Well, let's take an example with lots of miles and lots of movement. I intend to rob somebody in Virginia Beach. I get the gun, I get in my car, I leave here this afternoon. If I get to New Kent and stop, have I committed an attempted robbery of the person in Virginia Beach?
I think academically, yes. However, that type of scenario, you're going to obviously have a proof problem at trial, because you're still going to have to prove that there was preparation and that you were, in fact, moving towards the completion.
But in Judge Russell's scenario, doesn't it depend on whether he abandoned the intent, not whether he started or took an act back in Richmond? And here, the intent is not an issue.
Well, I mean, if you have an unbroken chain of events, which I think we have in this case, starting with preparation, movement towards completion, arrival at the scene, continued acting in furtherance of that intent, putting on the mask, gathering the guns, going down the alleyway, there's with this unbroken chain of events, which I think is distinguishable from Jordan and Hobson, then we clearly have a situation where you can almost anywhere along that chain do it. Now,
are you suggesting that there doesn't need to be any linkage at all to an actual element of the offense? In other words, you know, theoretically, if I mask, you know, that's going to be intimidating from that point, and that's one of the elements of the offense. So if I abandon the operation at that point, I've still committed an attempt, I would suggest. But if I abandon the whole concept when I'm still sitting in the parking lot in the car, you know, and I haven't done anything to put anybody in fear or acquire personal property by force, threat, or any of the stuff that would be an element of the crime, has it progressed beyond mere preparation at that point?
And I think the court's noted that there are two competing public policy interests here. One is clearly you would like to encourage defendants to not engage in conduct that's going to harm citizens. If that means abandoning it before the crime is complete, we'd obviously want to encourage that. The other public policy interest here, I think we don't want gangs of armed individuals roaming streets looking for robbery victims. Once they're out of the car, going down the alley with a sawed-off shotgun, a hammer, wearing masks, we've gone past the point of we want to encourage them at this point to stop. They've already engaged in enough conduct and citizens are put in danger.
Can I ask you on the second assignment of error, because you raised the sawed-off shotgun, which I think a reasonable inference is that he has it on him, given the chase and where it ends up being found after he ran into that fence area. But he never produces it or uses it. It's not clear he has it on it. Given the Supreme Court's decision in Rowland, I believe it is, from 2011, how does the Commonwealth argue that we should affirm on the firearm conviction?
I do think this is one of the more interesting aspects of this case, because the crime of use of a firearm is use or attempted use of a firearm. And now we have use or attempted use of a firearm in an attempted robbery. So we have a double attempt situation going on here, which semantically is difficult. But there's nothing to indicate that this should not be analyzed like any other crime. Is there an intent, and is there an act in furtherance? Here the intent is he intends to use the firearm because he stated he's there to offer protection. And the act in furtherance is he's taken it with him, wearing a mask, down the alleyway. So under the same rubric we would analyze any, I think, crime. I think here we have sufficient evidence for that as well.
But he's convicted of attempted robbery, but the sentencing order says use of a firearm in commission of the felony.
It does, and I mean, that's, again, a semantic issue, but...
But that's what the statute says, attempt to use.
It's all
in the same statute.
It's called using a firearm constitutes use or attempting to use.
Of a firearm is also attempted use of a firearm.
It is.
Under the statute.
It is. So I would suggest that's a semantics issue that, while awkward, doesn't actually change the meaning of the argument or the reason for affirming
it. You would agree we would analyze that independently of the attempted crime itself, right? I mean,
yeah.
In other words, just because you have a completed attempt doesn't necessarily have a completed attempt to use of a firearm.
Obviously. But I think the same rubric would be used to make that analysis. I don't think you'd have to do a separate type of analysis because it's an attempted crime during an attempted crime.
And here the indictment specifically charges to use, attempt to use, or display in a threatening manner.
That's correct.
So whatever the shorthand the trial court used in its sentencing order, the indictment is the offense that he was convicted of.
That is correct.
In that vein, do we have the same analysis then? We have to determine at what point the attempt to use the firearm, in other words, is acquiring the firearm sufficient evidence of attempt, or do you actually have to go further than that?
Well, again, going back to, I think, standard analysis, first of all, the first element is intent, which I think we have by his statements, that he was there to offer protection for Tripp. And then we have the action furtherance. And again, I would suggest the same type of evidence is going to lead to that, which is he was had it with him. And there's no photographs I'm aware of in the appendix, but a sawed-off shotgun is not a small item, so I'm going to assume, or I think it's a reasonable inference, that he was carrying this in his person. It wasn't, like, in his pants. It wasn't in a coat. He was carrying it. And taking it down the alleyway, wearing a mask, all of those things taken in consideration are going to establish an act in furtherance of his intent to use the firearm to protect Tripp.
Mr. Stollard, the Commonwealth has asked us to revisit Hobson and Jordan. And so my question to you is, clearly you believe Hobson and Jordan were guilty of attempt. At what point in that narrative were they guilty of attempt? When they got to the 7-Eleven, when they put on the mask, when they drew the weapons, where would the Commonwealth have had us draw the line in Hobson and Jordan?
I have a two-part answer to that. First of all, sometimes I have epiphanies with insight. Sometimes my colleagues have epiphanies. And I would suggest, I think it is possible to distinguish those cases from the present case without necessarily affecting the holding in those cases. I think one factual difference this court can see between Jordan and Hobson in the present case is Jordan and Hobson went to the store. They then hid in the bushes. They would go in and out from time to time. But I think arguably their movement towards the completion took a pause or stopped. And they were rethinking, possibly coming up with a new intent. It's like, well, okay, it's more crowded than we thought. Perhaps we need to readdress what we're doing here. In this case, there was no such stopping. There was a continual unbreaking chain from getting out of the car, going down the alley until the police arrived. There was no, let's stop, let's think about this. Let's send somebody in to look at it, reassess. There was a continuing ongoing process. I think factually it is possible to distinguish the two. With that said, I also think that, again, the language in Martin talking about movement towards. When they arrived on the scene with the masks and the firearms, they completed the attempt.
But isn't one of the distinguishing factors of those two prior cases is the court determined intent through circumstantial evidence. So we really don't know at which time, at which point in all of this movement they developed the intent to rob. And until you have the intent to rob, you clearly can't have an act in furtherance of that.
That's correct. And I also point out that that's another issue with Jordan and Hobson is that the court just kind of blanketly said, well, given the intent was to rob, we find there's no act in furtherance.
Well, and following up on that, it seems to me, of course, those cases talk about the scouting of the crime scene, if you will.
Yes.
Inferentially, that's clearly preparation. I mean, scouting, you know, at least to me, suggests that you haven't made a final decision as to if you're going to rob, how you're going to rob. I realize it ties into the whole intent issue because clearly you may not decide to go through with a robbery and form that intent until after you've scouted the premises. So,
sure.
So there, I mean, obviously, there, to Judge Petty's point, here, though, the intent seems to be as crystal clear.
This is as good as it's going to get, I think.
So the issue is the overt act in furtherance of and in furtherance of what?
Right. And I think, as the court noted earlier, speaking with my opposing counsel, the issue is going to be when did the preparation stop, when did the attempt occur? Here, I think, as the court noted earlier, the preparation in this case was deciding to rob the specific person, deciding what was needed to do that, how many people were going to be involved, what items they needed to do that. They decided three people. They decided on a hammer, several masks, a firearm. They collected those items. They set out on a movement towards completing this crime. They arrived at the parking lot. They got out of the car. They put on the masks or hoodies or whatever it may be, got the firearms, walked down the alley. At that point, they commenced the consummation of the crime. This was not the last proximate act, but it was a movement towards that act after preparation had been completed. Now, the problem, if I may, that sometimes occurs is the word preparation can mean most anything. Like, I'm preparing to pull out the gun. I'm preparing to tell him to give me the money. But clearly, the law intends there's going to be a space of time between preparation and the last proximate act before the crime is completed.
Well, the way I learned it in law school, the magic words were commencement of the consummation of the crime. Now, if I could put that in 21st century language, it strikes me that a synonym for that phrase would be the beginning of the commission of the crime. And if that's the case, then it seems to me, at least an argument can be made, that until you start executing factually one or more elements of the crime, you haven't gone beyond preparation. But once you pull the mask over your face or pull the gun out or say, give me all your money, and then, you know, now you're beginning the execution of the crime, and from that point, even if you never complete it, it's an attempt. Why isn't that a good bright line?
Absolutely, counsel.
Your Honor, and I agree that there are semantic problems with the way the language has been interpreted and how it's applied to the facts. I would suggest that the court's interpretation regarding that, then we've almost eliminated the requirement that it's not the last proximate act before the commission of the offense. If you actually have to start committing the offense in order for it to be an attempt, then I think we've eviscerated the requirement that it not be the last proximate act, which dates back to the 1889 case, I believe. I forget the name off the top of my head. But that's been the long-standing principle of Virginia for a long time. I understand it's a complicated issue. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions the court might have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate your argument. Mr. Vandenbroek, you have a whopping minute 32 seconds.
Can I ask you a real quick question?
If I decide
to rob the Neiman Marcus on Rodeo Drive in Los Angeles, and there's absolutely no question I intend to do that, and I go on to buy the plane ticket to get to Los Angeles, is that an act in furtherance of my intent?
I'd say it's an act in furtherance of your intent, but is that sufficient for an attempt to occur?
If that's an act in furtherance of my intent, why isn't turning the key to the car or anything else that is designed to deliver me to the location of the crime?
Part of the reason that it's difficult to draw a bright line on attempt is because of the public policy concerns that the Commonwealth pointed out earlier. To give the offender, we would prefer that they turn away from their crimes as long as possible and that we leave them the opportunity to do that. If you decide that you're going to commit a robbery and that you have to fly to another part of the country to do so, you might have 12, 24 hours in between making
But that's a question of abandonment of intent.
That's correct.
Not taking that initial step towards the commencement of the crime.
I think the better answer to Judge Petty's question is a problem for the California Court of Appeals, not us.
That's
why I only went to Virginia Beach.
That's true, Your Honor. What's interesting about the case before us and what's, as counsel pointed out, what we know from the statement that was made to the police that they had intent originally. What we don't know is what the intent was at the time that they encountered the police. What we do know is there was no victim and there was no principal in the first degree.
But isn't that because the police interrupted this and the victim doesn't actually have to live there? The victim could be, since he's apparently a known drug dealer, be delivering drugs to someone there. If you can't find the victim before the police get there, does that mean that there's no attempt?
If you can't, I'm sorry, my time.
Counsel, go ahead and answer Judge Beal's question.
I'd say, Your Honor, that's true. If what the evidence is that you are in the middle of looking for the victim at the time that you encounter police, but where the Commonwealth runs into a problem is we know that they had intent when they set out. We know that they had intent when they got there. But saying that they had that intent continued at the time that they encountered police when the person who planned the robbery had already disappeared and that the other two don't know where it is that they were going.
Why would I have my mask on if my intent didn't continue? I might not be able to do it because neither the principal nor the victim is there, but it seems to me that putting on the mask shows that I maintain that intent.
So actually, Your Honor, what the facts shows that it was said when they were standing in the parking lot, one of the officers said that he couldn't actually see what they were doing because it was dark. Another said that one may have put a mask on, but at the time that they encountered the two co-defendants in the alley, it was not said by anyone that anyone was actually wearing a mask at that time. One of them may have had a mask before they went into the alley, but after they went into the alley, one of the co-defendants, the one who planned the robbery, was no longer there, and no one had a mask on anymore. And also, my client was not found with a firearm at that time, so there's some problems about what happened after they entered that alley, and frankly, we don't know enough to be able to say.
Thank you, Mr. Vandenbroek.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we'll call the next case on the docket.